History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. On this podcast, I've talked more about the Ottoman Empire than probably should be on a history podcast. That's because that was my research field and I can't help it. But for people who like early modern history, the period from the 16th to 18th centuries, no doubt the Ottoman Empire was very important in world history. It controlled much of North Africa, the entire Arabian Peninsula, Anatolia, up to the Caucasus Mountains, what is modern-day Ukraine, north of the Black Sea, Eastern Europe, and Central Europe, including Hungary, up to the gates of Vienna. The 16th century Ottomans had extraordinary military power and monopolies on trade routes and controlled more territory and ruled over more people than any world power. They forced Europeans out of the Mediterranean and into the New World, kicking off the Age of Discovery. But despite its influence, the legacy of the Ottoman Empire has been downplayed, and much of its story has to do with how it influenced Western Europe, and then when Western Europeans arrived in the United States, that was the story. Well, there's a lot more to it than that, and today's guest, Alan Mikhail, the chair of the history department of Yale and an Ottomanist himself, argues that the Ottoman Empire, specifically embodied in one sultan, Sultan Selim, contributed a significant amount to creating the modern world. Sultan Selim lived from 1470 to 1520, and he ruled from 1512 to 1520. He expanded the Ottoman Empire outward from mostly what is today modern-day Turkey and the Balkans to completely take control of Egypt, parts of North Africa, the entire Arabian Peninsula, including the cities of Mecca and Medina, and was an incredible military leader. He nearly tripled the territory of the Ottoman Empire and built a governing structure that lasted into the 20th century. He was known by his subjects as God's shadow on earth, and took on the mantle of a Muslim leader, but had Christians and Jews under his domain as well. So what we do in this discussion is to connect the dots between the Ottoman Empire and world events, including Columbus's journey to America, the transatlantic slave trade, the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther wrote a whole lot on what he called the Turks, the Ottomans, and Christopher Columbus was constantly comparing the people he encountered and other conquistadors to Arabs. So key moments in Western civilization can be traced back to the West's attempts to work around the Ottoman Empire. And lastly, if those things don't sell you on their importance, the Ottoman Empire, after it conquered Yemen, controlled the first truly global commodity, and that's coffee, and made it the phenomenon that it is today, leading to the development of coffee shops that were a site of rebellion and anarchy in the Ottoman Empire, but also in Great Britain and later the United States. So a whole lot to look at here. A very important revisionist account of a critical moment in history, and a lot to bite off. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Alan Mikhail. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, I think you are the first Ottomanist that I've had on the show, so I hope this doesn't get too much into insider baseball for the listeners. I know from your scholarship, you looked at the history of animals in Egypt, and you have pivoted to a study of Sultan Selim I, or Selim the Grim, as he's known in older Western scholarship. So how did that pivot happen?
Yeah, so I am a scholar of the Ottoman Empire in the Arab world. And the Ottomans conquered what we, you know, usually think of as the Middle East today. That is the Levant and North Africa and Iraq in 1516, 1517. And so for someone who's interested in the history of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East and the Arab world, that's the beginning of that story. And the Sultan who did that was Selim I. So I, in my previous work, came to see that we don't really have a good understanding of that moment of 1516, 1517, when the Ottoman Empire more than doubled in size and the demographics of the empire shifted in really important ways that we could talk about. But we didn't have a very good understanding of that period and its implications for global history. So the Ottomans conquer the Mamluk Empire in 1516, 1517. So for historians of the Mamluk Empire, that's kind of the end of the story. So they kind of stop there. for Ottoman historians, it's kind of the beginning of a story, so they begin there, but actually dwelling in and around those years is something that historians generally haven't done.
Yeah, I'm interested to dig into how this changes the Ottoman Empire because its demographics are fundamentally altered. Before we dig into that, could you give some context, maybe some bullet points of the facts that a person reading a textbook about the Middle East would learn of the Ottoman Empire from 1453 and its growing conquest up to 1517? How does the 1517 conquest fit into this larger story of the Ottoman Empire?
So the general dates that are given for the Ottoman Empire are 1300 to World War I. So that is over 600 years of history. It makes the Ottomans the longest lasting empire in Islamic history, one of the longest lasting empires in world history generally. The Ottomans often called themselves the successors to the Roman Empire. And indeed, they came closest to the Roman Empire in their geography and matching the geography of the Roman Empire. So over 600 years of history, the Ottoman Empire was a very different empire in different periods. It was a kind of late medieval empire in the Balkans and in Western Anatolia. It was then a large early modern empire in the 16th and the 17th centuries. It was a reforming state in the 19th century. It was a player in World War I. So no single Ottoman historian can cover all of that ground. I, in this book, am really interested in the period that you mentioned, from 1453 to 1520. So Selim, the protagonist of the book, lives from 1470 to 1520. His grandfather is Mehmet II, who conquers Constantinople in 1453. And for historians of the Mediterranean and of the globe, 1453 is a seminal date, right? For Christendom, they likened it to plucking out one of the eyes of Christendom. This is one of the quotes of a pope, that Rome and Constantinople were the two eyes of Christendom, and the Ottomans plucked out one of the eyes in 1453. So in 1453, the Ottoman Empire is still a majority Christian state. The largest demographic of people living in the Ottoman Empire were culturally Greek and Orthodox in their religion, so Orthodox Christians. The Ottomans, of course, were the family of the Ottomans, the dynasty, were Muslims who had a kind of Central Asian Turkic lineage. So they are a minority in terms of their demographics, ruling over a majority Christian population. One of the interesting things about 1516, 1517 is that a lot of that changes. So with the incorporation of large parts of the Mamluk Empire in the Middle East and North Africa, this is the first time in over 200 years, again, if we take the empire beginning in 1300, 1516, 1517, this is the first time that the majority of the people living under Ottoman rule are Muslims of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. This is the first time that the Sultan has a legitimate claim to being the Caliph. The Caliph technically means the ruler that possesses Mecca and Medina, the holy cities. So whereas previously, for kind of rhetorical purposes, sultans often called themselves Caliph, Selim is the first one to be both Sultan and Caliph. Having that those titles makes him one of the most important rulers in the Muslim world. 1516, 1517 is also the first moment that the Ottomans have territory in North Africa. It puts them in the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean world. It gives them basically all of the Eastern Mediterranean. So for all these reasons, it's a really, really important date.
Well, this is a date that when Ottomanists look at 1517, they'll talk about invented traditions. And I always get the author of that confused with Imagined Communities. Is that Eric Hobsbawm or am I getting that wrong?
Imagined Communities is Benedict Anderson.
Right. Did Eric Hobsbawm do invented traditions?
Yes.
Okay, there we go.
The invention of tradition.
Of traditions. Okay. Yeah. So that's a famous article talking about how a nation imagines its traditions stretching back centuries, are recent inventions, sometimes are complete fictions. And you know what? The Ottoman Empire plays that game just as well as anyone else. And there are these with 1517, where the Ottoman Empire conquers the Hejaz, the area with Mecca and Medina, and it's presented with the standards of the Prophet. So as if saying the Ottomans are welcomed in this continuous line of caliphs and have the full legitimacy of what the Mamluks and the Abbasids did. So could you talk about what are the invented traditions that come out of 1517, centuries later in the Ottoman Empire? And then what actually happened? Did Selim cognitively think of himself as this new role? Did the people on the ground in Egypt and the Hejaz think of that? What was going on?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in terms of the kind of the invention of a story and mythology about 1516, 1517, and how that plays into later Ottoman rule, this is the moment in which the Ottomans can claim, and I think actually legitimately claim, that they are the strongest power in the Muslim world, right? Not only because they have Mecca and Medina and that kind of rhetorical honorific of holding Mecca and Medina, but they also have more territory than any other Muslim empire. They control trade routes between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean, which is really important. We can get into that a little bit more. And so this is the moment when the Ottomans have been projecting their role as a world conquering empire, as the fulcrum of world power, as possessing universal rule, as legitimately being heirs to both the Roman empires, as we talked about before, and the Islamic tradition, and bringing those two things together. So that's the kind of rhetoric that that you'll see at various periods after 1516, 1517. It depends on which sultan we're talking about. But Selim is the father of Suleiman the Magnificent, the most famous Ottoman sultan that most people will know about. And you see that language of universal rule really come to be developed during his reign. Selim is not alive long enough to really develop that himself. But that comes to fruition later. It's also interesting in that, you know, if we zoom towards the end of the empire, and then even into the beginnings of the Turkish Republic, there's actually a rejection of that tradition, right? A rejection of the character of the Ottoman Empire as a Muslim empire, right? And this obviously comes to its apex under Ataturk, in which he rejects Islam as a kind of legitimating force for the Turkish Republic, the Latinization of the alphabet, etc., a kind of distancing of the Ottoman Empire and its Muslim characteristics. And just like during the Ottoman centuries, this also goes through waves. So now, Erdogan, the now president of Turkey, former prime minister, now president, embraces Selim and Selim's legacy as a Muslim ruler for his own rhetorical purposes. So, you know, I end the book with a discussion of the naming of the third bridge over the Bosphorus Strait.
Yes.
So the first bridge is just called the Bosphorus Bridge. The second bridge is named after Mehmet the Conqueror, Selim's grandfather, who conquers Constantinople in 1453. So that makes great sense, the uniter of both sides of the city of Istanbul, of Asia and Europe. And the third bridge, which was opened just a few years ago, Erdogan purposely named after Selim. So he chose that for very particular reasons, because Selim embodies how Erdogan wants his Turkey to be seen, as one that is a bulwark of power in the Middle East, one that embraces the Islamic tradition as a source of strength and of power. And also for domestic reasons, Selim undertook one of the largest massacres in Ottoman history when he killed 40,000, we think, Shiites in Anatolia. And I'm happy to talk about that a bit more, but he's also a symbol of Turkish power, as opposed to Kurdish or Shiite or Arab or Greek or Armenian, etc. So for all those reasons, he's very useful for Erdogan. So that's part of Erdogan's sort of invented tradition.
Yeah, he has a very eclectic reading of history, Erdogan. The statement a few years ago that Columbus discovered mosques in Cuba and due to a misreading of a misreading of a misreading. So
that's actually maybe a place that we can talk about a little bit, because I, you know, part of the book actually deals with Columbus in a very different way than Erdogan wants to treat him.
Well, I want to get to one more thing, because that is the main point of your book, the world historical importance of Selim that most haven't seen. One last thing before we telescope out is, I guess a couple of things. First, I want to talk about Selim himself as a leader, and then also what this huge demographic influx of Arabic speakers and people who are in many ways culturally different from the hinterlands of Anatolia and Rumelia of the Ottoman Empire. So you talk about Selim as a leader who only rules for 8 years, but you say he eschews palace intrigue, factionalism, and greed in favor of a quest to restore the empire to its former military glory. So could you expound on that?
Sure. So Selim is unique in that he was his father's fourth son. Almost always up to that point, it was the eldest and the most favored son who became Sultan. He is also unique in that he deposes his father while his father is still alive. So during Selim's reign is one of the first times that we have a former living sultan and a current living sultan. And that presents all kinds of problems for observers of the empire. So because he's unfavored, Selim is posted to the far reaches of the empire at this point, to Trabzon on the far east, on the Black Sea, which is, you know, the boondocks, right? It's way far out. Anyone who has any interest in becoming a powerful member of the empire wants to be close to Istanbul and the capital and the palace. But he's posted way out on the frontier. Because of that, though, he develops a strong sense that the empire needs to be defended. That strong military power is an important part of being a sovereign, that there are enemies all around, right? For him, the most immediate enemies are a group of tribal principalities in the Caucasus, today Georgia, Azerbaijan, that area, and northern Iran. The most potent of those will develop into what becomes the Safavid Empire, but during the years in which Selim is in Trabzon, they're still kind of rival factions fighting it out. And they will conduct raids on his territory, on Trabzon itself, and then to the south of Trabzon. And so he's always having to defend against these enemies. And so he will capture some of the members of these royal families of these tribal principalities. And that will get him in trouble with his father, the Sultan, because the heads of those tribal principalities will lobby the Sultan and say, hey, you know, your bloodthirsty son has captured a member of our royal family, and that's not how we do diplomacy. So we would like to, work out a deal whereby you can give us back our son and return to a kind of status quo of peace. Selim doesn't see that. He sees his power as deriving from the use of military force, and so that causes a conflict between his father, the Sultan Bayezid II. And himself. Bayezid doesn't want to rock the boat. The empire is very rich at this point. He wants to conduct trade, not have too many wars, especially way out in the east in Trabzon, because it's very far from Istanbul, and to provision and send troops that way, you know, takes a long time and is very expensive. And he wants peace and prosperity in the empire. Selim on the frontier is pushing against that and conducts, as I said, several of those raids. So that brings him into conflict with his father. And he uses that against his father to say, that my father is weak. He's not defending the honor of the empire. He's not using the empire's military to extend its power, to defend the honor of the state, etc. So that's what I mean by eschewing the kind of factionalism and kind of comfortable rule of a sultan because he's really out there kind of on the frontier.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Okay, and one other thing before we get to the world historical impact of Selim. With the story of the Ottoman Empire, for those who don't know much about it, except in as much as it relates to European history, they would know dates that are symbolic. The Battle of Lepanto in 1571, the Siege of Vienna in 1683. These are typically moments where, from the European history perspective, the Ottoman Empire was on the cusp of who knows what, a complete takeover of Europe, and that would have altered Western Europe completely. Dates that I think for most Ottomans would think are symbolic, but not as important as many people think. But the point being is that when the Ottoman Empire is conceived, it's conceived of as the preeminent Islamic power and the sort of symbol of the Muslim world, if you will. But what most people don't think of is that it reaches that point after centuries of startling evolution, where the Ottoman Empire begins where a chieftain on the fringes of the Byzantine Empire and who is a vassal of the daughter state of the Mongol Empire, so a copy of a copy of a copy, this very, very small principality declares independence, and then over years and decades and centuries of growth become this thing that's threatening Europe. But the transitional evolutionary leap forwards happens at different times, and I think for a long time people would ascribe that to Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, who rules from 1520 to 1566, and conquers a lot of Europe, and they kind of conceive the Ottoman Empire's identity as being the foe of Europe. But I never really thought about that with Selim. Just sort of, I mean, there's the conquest of the Middle East too, which has its impact. But and I always envision that as well. They're now the custodians of Mecca and Medina, so now there's all this, you know, ideological importance that comes with that. But I never really thought about it with like a demographic shift of majority Muslim and an Arab population. So how does having a large Arab population affect that kind of evolutionary shift, if you will, of the Ottoman Empire?
Yeah, so it affects it in multiple ways. One is by the sheer geographic explosion of the empire. It more than doubles in size in a couple years. The empire has to develop all kinds of new bureaucratic structures, legal regimes, administrative practices to bring those territories into the empire and then to rule them. So Suleiman, again, the sultan everybody knows, is known as the lawgiver. In English, we say the magnificent. In Turkish, it's Kanuni, the lawgiver. And one of the arguments that I make is, why does he have to promulgate so many laws? It's to integrate all of these territories into the empire. And that's because of Selim's geographic expansion of the empire. So that's one answer. Another answer as to what this demographic shift means is that I think it is the case that, quote unquote, the Islamic character of the empire changes in this period. I think there is a stronger embrace of what it means to be a Muslim ruler, what it means to have the legitimacy of those centuries of Islamic history behind you. When Selim conquers the Mamluk Empire, very important cities of Islamic learning, of course, Mecca and Medina, but Cairo, Damascus, Jerusalem, Aleppo, he brings and invites many scholars, artists, artisans, writers, thinkers from those cities to come to Istanbul, Constantinople. And it is the case that after 1516, 1517, Istanbul becomes one of the global centers of Islamic learning, teaching, writing in a way that it wasn't before. You could say it was Baghdad earlier, then Cairo, and then Istanbul. So that's very important for the history of Islam and Muslim learning. It also means that you do have this influx of Arabs into the empire, but it also means that Turkish has a very different place in the kind of pantheon of Islamic learning. Whereas before, the languages of art and of theoretical writing and craftsmanship and writing in Islamic letters was Arabic and Persian. this is really when Turkish begins to earn a place for itself as one of these languages of Islamic learning. Of course, there was writing before, but it's really after this period in which the place of the Ottoman Empire within the Muslim world changes, and then the place of Islam in the Ottoman world also changes.
Right. And as someone who's taken a text seminar, texts from the 1400s, early 1500s are much easier. When you get into the 15, 1600s, I just remember getting slaughtered with these court chroniclers or writing in Persian and nightmares. So,
right.
All right. So let's get to where you plant your flag in the book. That I hope we've set the stage enough so people understand the background of Selim, his accomplishments within the Ottoman case. And that's how most people understand his story of very significant for the Ottoman Empire, but he's setting the stage for later Ottoman greatness by other sultans. And the story of the Ottoman Empire is mostly self-contained, but only important for world history in as much as it affects the course of events for Western European history. You say that his reign affects the making of the modern world. So let's get into that. How does he do that?
Sure. Right. So that, as you say, is one of the goals of the book. And it begins from the observation that for global politics at the turn of the 16th century and into the first half of the 16th century, the Ottomans are central players. Everybody talks about that and sees that. Machiavelli writes about the Ottomans. The Spanish and the Portuguese write about the Ottomans, the Italians, even the Ming write about the Ottomans as major players in geopolitics. So that's one observation. And yet, when we talk about this period and its importance for world history, we talk about 1492 and Columbus, and then also the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. We talk about the Reformation. We talk about the opening up of the, quote unquote, opening up of the Indian Ocean world. I mean, in all those grand narratives of world history, which I agree are important for our understanding of world history, the Ottomans don't really have much of a role to play in those stories. And again, yet they were observed to be one of the most important players in global politics at the time. So part of the book is to restore the place of the Ottomans in those grand narratives of global history, and to show how they were actually intimately involved in all of those things and numerous other events that I lay out in the book.
All right. Well, I really want to dive into this, but maybe as a way to get into it further, I'd like to compare your book to another book that makes the same argument, but I think makes it badly. So, and that is Jack Weatherford's Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. Nice book. It's very readable. I understand why people like it. But he gives the Mongols credit for everything. He gives them credit for the Renaissance. He gives them credit for, I think, the Constitution of the United States, that Thomas Jefferson's got ideas of government from the Mongols. He gives them credit for the ideas of religious plurality because there's multiple religions in the Mongolian Empire, which I think for a lot of scholars read it say, I mean, the Mongolians were pragmatists. They didn't have a grand unified idea of religious pluralism. That was just how you would make an empire like that work. And the Mongolians were a transit hub between East and West, but how much ideological credit do you give to a transit hub, right? I mean, a gas station in Iowa, a very large truck stop on the intersection between Interstate 80 and Interstate 35, occupies important geography, but that doesn't make it the center of tolerance and world's, you know, historical significance. So like that's the extreme end. I don't think you're saying that. So I'm going to give you one over Jack Weatherford. So how would you say that the Ottomans aren't just, you know, at the crossroads, but they're merely a placeholder and not much more?
Yeah. Well, you know, I go to the sources. So
there you go. That's a good start.
That's really how I began with this is when you read, for example, early Spanish accounts of the Caribbean, right? So, you know, Columbus's letters, Cortez, etc. There are these odd mentions of Islam, Muslims, the Moors, Saracens, etc. And when I had taught these things before, and I always thought that was just very strange and odd. You know, what are Moors doing in Mexico in 1508? And so that got me thinking where are these writers, people like Columbus and Cortez, where are they Where are they formed? How are they formed? In what world are they formed? And you know, you quickly come to realize, and I'm obviously not the first person to say this, that they're formed in a world that is very much shaped by this encounter between Christendom and Islam in the Mediterranean, right? Columbus, for example, is born in 1451, 2 years before 1453 in Genoa. Genoa is a commercial empire that has very deep trading and political relationships with ports in the Black Sea, in the Eastern Mediterranean. They're very much in interaction with what will become the Ottoman Empire. And they're also a crusader entrepôt, so lots of crusading ships would leave from Genoa. So there is in the air already a sense of kind of Islam and Christendom in Genoa in Columbus's youth. He then sails in several commercial enterprises early, very early when he's a teenager, to places like Chios, which is now a Greek island in the Aegean, very, very close to the Anatolian shore of the Ottoman Empire, right? So he's bumping up against the Ottomans. He also sails on a group of ships that goes to North Africa, again, very, very early in his sailing career. So there's some sense that Islam is there. And then, of course, in Spain, when he's seeking out a patron, he's very much involved in the what's called the reconquest of Spain, right? The conquest of Granada in 1492. And in the first opening of his diaries, he brings together those two major events of 1492. He says, after the conquest of Granada, you, the king and queen, have decided to allow me to sail west to India, right? So I think scholars have usually separated those two things. They've separated the conquest of Granada and then everything that comes after that, the unification of Spain, the expulsion of the Jews, the attempted conquest in North Africa, etc. They've separated that and the story of 1492 crossing the Atlantic. Whereas Columbus put them together, and I want to put them together. I want to keep them together and narrate a story of how this major geopolitical, eschatological, cultural war, if you want, between Islam and Christendom of the old world, how that affected this very early experience of Europeans in the Caribbean. It's not as though, 30 days at sea, they suddenly forget, everything that formed them. And so that's my explanation for why Columbus says that Taino women, when he lands in the Caribbean, look like, quote, Moorish women. Why Cortez says there are 400 mosques in Mexico, right?
Right.
He calls Montezuma a sultan, right? For them, the kind of major civilizational other in their minds is Islam, right? And Islam is a squishy category for them. It's not the Ottomans, right? They often refer to Moors, Turks, and Saracens, and they just trade these terms. They're not very clear about the differences between those things. It's a kind of package of things that are considered Muslim and other. It's also you see it in their careers. Cortez, for example. It helps with the reconquest of southern Spain and fights in North Africa against Muslim states. He goes to the New World, goes to Mexico, and he comes back. And the final battle of his life is in Algeria, right? Columbus, similarly, is there at the conquest of Granada and takes that with him to the New World. So, that's one of the ways in which I see Islam and the Ottomans as the dominant Muslim power of the day fitting into something like the early years of European colonization of the Caribbean.
Right. And I remember I was teaching a class on Christian-Muslim relations and talking about this period and how certain trends and styles were becoming popular in Europe from the Ottoman Empire. And a student asked if this is Orientalism, and they're thinking of the 19th century type of Orientalism. I said, well, no, it's different because that has to do a lot with colonialism. If we're looking at the late 15th, early 16th centuries, the power relations are completely inverted, like you said.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
To look at something else with this, you mentioned the influence of the Protestant Reformation. And I'm very curious about this because I've talked about this a bit on the show, and there are scholars like Tiana Kristich and Darren Tarzioğlu who say that the age of confessionalization, where the lines between different types of Christian groups is hardening in the 16th century, and that leads to the split between Protestants and Catholics. And there are monarchs and others who make themselves the patron of these religious groups. And the same thing is happening in the Ottoman Empire and the Safavid Empire, where you have a self-proclaimed Sunni empire fighting a self-proclaimed Shiite empire. And that same type of hardening of lines that's happening in Europe is also happening in the Middle East. But it sounds like you're saying you're adding to this conversation with Selim and the Protestant Reformation. So please tell me about that.
Yeah. So the confessionalization literature is one that I basically, in broad outlines, accept the kind of argument that you just laid out. Initially when I came to this, I found it curious that in the same year that Selim finishes off the Mamluk Empire, that we also have the Protestant Reformation. Was there a relationship between these two things, or was it just coincidence that they happened in the same year? So again, I started reading the European sources, Luther. Luther writes a ton about who he calls the Turks, the Ottomans, mm-hmm. but he always calls them the Turks. And some scholars even think that he wanted to sponsor the first German translation of the Quran. Didn't end up happening, but he was supposedly interested in being a part of that. So why is he interested in the Turks? He's interested in who he calls the Turks because of Catholicism, right? He is a Catholic priest. And the way that Selim's 1517 is a part of Luther's 1517 is that he very much sees military and political weakness as a sign of punishment from God. So why is it that Muslim powers seem to be thriving, gaining territory, even taking territory from Europeans in the Balkans? Selim's grandfather landed a battalion on the boot of Italy. So this encroaching sense of Islam. So why is Islam thriving when the Catholic Church and Catholic powers seem to be losing territory, seem to be weak? And for him, that comes from their moral depravity, the moral depravity of the Pope. So he sees in the mirror of the Ottomans Catholic moral failing. So that's the first thing. He also becomes interested in certain theological dimensions of Islam. Iconoclasm is the one that scholars usually point to, the fact that in Islam we don't have the kind of we don't have as much human representation as we do in Catholicism, the sense that there's not an ecclesiastical hierarchy within Islam is also something that is appealing to him. And so in his debates against the Catholic Church, he sees the Ottoman Empire as what he calls the lash of iniquity, that it is a punishment sent by God for Catholicism's sins. And until Christendom, right, until Christianity deals with its sins, it's going to continually lose to this external Muslim enemy. So that's part of what he sees as the need for reform in the church. Now, I don't want to say that it's all about Islam for Luther, but it is a mirror that he uses to make some of these arguments against the Catholic Church. There's also something to be said that of the kind of realpolitik that is happening at this time, because Catholic powers are concerned about the Ottomans and other Muslim powers in North Africa, their armies are dedicated to other priorities and are not as readily sent to quash a kind of internal rebellion that Luther represents. Had they done that, had they had the kind of bandwidth to be able to deploy their armies wherever they wanted to in this period, you know, maybe Luther's revolution wouldn't have been able to take hold in the way that it did.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He writes all about the Turks, as he calls them, and says, for Germans, provided their conquest reaches this far, how do you continue to live faithful witness as a Christian under Ottoman rule? So it was very germane to many of his writings. Well, for listeners who maybe can't connect the dots with global politics and what's happening in the early modern era, one thing that they can connect with is coffee. So you mentioned that as one of the first major global commodities, the Ottomans discovered this in Yemen. And what does that look like from an Ottoman context? Are we talking about, I don't know, 20th century Saudi Arabia control of oil or the De Beers family controlling the global diamond trade? Tell us about coffee.
Okay. Again, 1516, 1517, one of the territories they conquer is Yemen. It's not brought fully under Ottoman control for another few decades, but it is brought into the empire in this period. And coffee had been brought to Yemen from across the Red Sea, from Ethiopia, maybe a century or so before. And it was known in the markets of Yemen, but not much beyond Ethiopia and Yemen. So the Ottomans discovered in Yemen, they quickly take to it. And because of the unity provided by Salim's conquest now, Yemen is part of a political empire that stretches to Iraq and Bulgaria and Algeria. So through the commercial and social institutions created by the Ottomans, coffee is able to spread up from Yemen throughout the Ottoman Empire and then eventually to Eastern Europe and then into Western Europe and then also to Southeast Asia and then around the world. So the Ottomans are very important for the spread of coffee. So in the Amsterdam Stock Exchange in the 18th century, coffee from Yemen represents something like 85% of the global purchases of coffee come from Yemeni coffee. That will change drastically later. But in that period, most of the world's coffee, up to 85%, comes from Yemen. The Ottomans are really, really important also because they develop that institution that none of us could survive without, and that is the coffee shop. The Ottomans are the first folks who create a dedicated space for the consumption of coffee. And of course, it's not just about coffee, but it's also about hanging out with your friends, playing games, smoking, listening to music, etc. So scholars often look to the Ottoman coffee shop as the origins of Starbucks, of the modern cafe, and then also to more ephemeral kinds of things, of something like conviviality or a culture of conversation, that the coffee house as a realm of the public sphere in which people gather for leisure and conversation. Coffee houses are often pointed to as some of the first spaces in the Ottoman world to be illuminated at night, because they were so popular and because people, and when I say people, it's mostly men, want to gather at night and hang out, et cetera, right? A space apart from the home. And, you know, the coffee shops just explode once they come on the scene. The first coffee shop opened ever, we think, is probably in Damascus in the 1530s. So if you think the Ottomans conquer Yemen in 1517, it takes about a decade and a half for coffee to travel up from Yemen to Damascus in Syria, and then for someone to open a dedicated space for the consumption of coffee.
Right. And I have an older episode on coffee houses as for listeners who want to check that out. The Ottoman Empire shuts them down in the 17th century. So does England, I think, in the Restoration period after the Glorious Revolution, because they're seen as hotbeds of activism. John Adams said Americans should drink coffee. There's an apocryphal story that that's why we drink coffee instead of tea after the Boston Tea Party. So coffee shops today, with hipsters writing Game of Thrones fan fiction, we don't think of them as hotbeds of revolution, but hey, it's all there in the record. Well, there are so many avenues to explore here, but maybe an open-ended question, so you can tie this up in any manner that you prefer. Let's say that you're commissioned by an academic publisher, Routledge, who, or whoever makes those textbooks for first or second year undergraduates who are taking history of the world from, I don't know, 1500 to 1800 or some sort of survey course on the early modern world. How would you rewrite that book to give Selim and that period in the Ottoman Empire the place that you think it deserves?
Yeah, the most important thing is for us to break out of this sense that everything in the past 500 years can be explained through the history of Europe in one way or another, just to be very crude about it. As I said, for contemporary writers in the period around 1500, the Ottomans are a constant presence, as are other powers around the world that are outside of Europe. But the Ottomans, as the most neighborly and the closest and the most politically and militarily salient for European powers, are there more than anyone else. So it would be to expand the kind of, to open up the aperture a little bit larger for students to understand that the world that made the modern world was a complicated one in which it wasn't just Christendom, it wasn't just Europe, but it was also North Africa and the Middle East and Russia and the Indian Ocean world and East Asia that were a part of what is our, what would become our world today. And so one of the ways of doing that is to show just how closely tied the Ottomans were to all of, again, these world-changing events that we've discussed, 1492, the Reformation, coffee. We didn't talk so much about the Portuguese and the Indian Ocean world, but that's also a story in which the Ottomans are major players. So to kind of hold that complexity, I think students can handle that. They don't need very easy stories. So the very easy story that, you know, Europe handed things off to the United States, and then we have freedom and liberty and democracy. You know, that's not a story that we buy anymore, and that's been challenged in all kinds of ways. But I think the story hasn't been revised to include the major power of the day, which were the Ottomans. So that's one of the ways that I would begin to revise some of this story.
And I support that, if nothing else, to increase the employability of Ottomanists, which is what everyone strives for. This is sort of a bonus question. The sobriquet that Selim had for a very long time in Western scholarship was Selim the Grim. Do you think he deserves that or not?
Right. So, you know, this is all whenever someone is writing about a historical figure, right? A historian has the question of their relationship to that figure. So I've always had a kind of one foot in, one foot out relationship to Selim. So he's not a hero in my story. He did some very bad things. I think he was savvy. I think he was highly strategic in the way that he structured his life. I think he was very focused on his goals. But yeah, he did a lot of bad things. As I mentioned before, I mean, one of the largest massacres in Ottoman history until the end of the 19th century. He was constantly basically engaged in war. Many Ottoman sultans were, but he was as well. You know, one of the reasons that he got that name, the Grim, is it goes back to the kind of succession struggle that I mentioned at the beginning. In that, you know, he kills his two older brothers as part of the succession battle to take over the throne. Some people think that he even had his father killed. His father dies in sort of dubious circumstances. You know, the jury's out on that. You know, he was a Machiavellian strategist. He was politically brutal. And so I don't want to sugarcoat that in any sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Very true. That's how things get done in the Ottoman Empire. Many of it is unpleasant. If you're a vizier and you don't do well, you get executed. And it's a very Darwinian situation, but that's the Ottoman Empire. Well, there is a lot to unpack here. And for listeners who want to dive in more, I highly recommend they check out Alan's book, which is called God's Shadow, Sultan Selim, His Ottoman Empire and the Making of the Modern World. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic Spymasters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivy, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WNWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.